There is something healing that can be brought out of an encounter. And what makes an encounter and not just an analytic hour session is this idea of I and thou, the two thous who are going to be respecting each other.
We are here today to talk about a person who lived 80 years ago. It's an early psychoanalyst, and his name is Hans Trieb. I would want to start off the conversation by asking, how come you started to write about Hans?
Well, thank you very much, Jakob, for inviting me back, and thank you for facilitating this discussion, because I don't get many chances to talk about Trieb, but I dare say that few of us do. He's become a kind of marginalized figure, and although I think that's changing, and we know that there is editorial work going on that's bringing his work out, so it's a good moment for us to have this discussion about him. I came across him simply in the course of doing research out of the doctoral work on Jung and Nietzsche, and of course one of the things that I became aware of was the huge amount of seminar work that Jung did, and this led to the broader question of analytical psychology as a kind of culture. There's all the stories about Jung setting up the Psychologische Club in Zurich as he was beginning to find his own way and formulate his own approach. And even though I'd decided to focus pretty clearly on Jung and Nietzsche, I became aware of a bigger question that's in the background there, which you would describe, I think, as you know, the analytic culture. The discursive culture around Jung as he begins to set out his intellectual stall, if you like. And I know that there's been work done, the important figures behind Bonningen that William McGuire did. I mean, it's a lovely book that he wrote called Bonningen and is a kind of intellectual history of Bonningen. And one of the things that I became aware of, but didn't have the opportunity then to actually follow through, would be a similar analysis of the analytic culture that Jung instigated, for which you need, it's basically time and money, and it's the old history. It's very, very difficult to get funding for a project that is as large as that. But it's a project which I think still needs to be done, which is to understand in a critical, that is to say, in an academic rather than just an anecdotal way, who were the figures around Jung that helped him formulate his ideas? At the moment, and for very good reasons, there's a big focus on we've had the Red Book, and now the Black Books, and as it were, the work that Jung was doing inside himself, the interior work that Jung undertook that led to the creation of analytical psychology. But there's another an accompanying side, which is figures who are on the outside, the people that he knew, not just the tittle-tattle about female relations and his female friendships, but that sense of how was an analytic community founded. And Trieb is one of those figures, not the only one, but I think an interesting one, a significant one, and someone with whom I feel I have a kind of affinity and so on. And the reason why Trieb is so interesting is because he asks what is the purpose of psychoanalysis and proposes a view of it as something which is essentially synthetic, i.e. it's about synthesis. And this whole question of synthesis and the role of synthesis in psychoanalysis, for me, prompted a really kind of, in retrospect, obvious question. Why is analytical psychology called analytical psychology? I mean, it's obviously trying to distinguish itself from Psychoanalyse, from Freudian psychoanalysis. And it wasn't the only term that Jung used in order to describe what he was doing, as you know, sometimes called complex psychology, complexe Psychologie, and sometimes called archetypische Psychologie, sometimes called tiefen Psychologie. But analytical psychology is the label that's stuck. And in some ways, that seems to be a curious thing. Because if I've understood anything about analytical psychology, it's that its outlook is fundamentally a synthetic one. It is about bringing things together. It is about integration.
And that's also what Hans Trieb at times would call his psychotherapy, psychosynthesis, was it?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, the term is first used. So what I wanted to do was to try and do a little bit of intellectual history on it and work out where this term comes from. And as far as I can tell, the first time that the idea of psychosynthese is used and the term is used is in 1907 when the Swiss psychiatrist Dumengbert Sohler, there's a conference in 1907, Congress for Psychiatry and Psychology, and he gives a paper there and he uses this term, and Jung picks up on it. He writes an account in the Jahrbuch für psychoanalytische und psychopathologische Forschung in 1910, when he quotes the definition that Bitsoga gives of psychosynthese. What Jung writes is, he says, psychosynthesis can consist in taking the various individual conscious components and feeling, you have to nachempfinden them, you have to empathize with them in such a way that they can be invigorated by subterranean, by unconscious associated components, and in this way bring about a solution of the psychotraumatic symptoms. In other words, we've got this idea of synthesis, of bringing together, really quite early on in Bitsola and Jung picks up on. And I think it's related to the work that Jung is doing at the time. And Trieb is also there in the Borghölzli, and that, you know, there's a lot of experimental work that's going on. And one of the things that Jung is interested in, I think, is the difference between analytic judgments and synthetic judgments in terms of his work on word association. And I think that's, you know, the very early empirical side of Jung actually is tied up with this conceptual difference between analytic associations, analytic word associations, and synthetic word associations.
What about Roberto Asagioli?
Well,
today, if anyone asks, we say psychosynthesis, psychosynthesis, everyone would say, yeah, that is Roberto Asagioli. Yeah, can you see how he connects to this?
Absolutely. Well, he I think, takes this term of psychosynthesis and runs with it. Jung is very early on in the correspondence with Freud. He's aware of what Asagioli is doing, and he's a little bit skeptical, I think, about him, as they all are of each other. I mean, I think is, you know, Freud wants to propagate his view of psychoanalysis. Everybody's trying to define themselves and find their way forward. This would apply to, you know, all of them, Rank and Stecklin and you know, all of the people who are involved with Freud. But equally, Jung, who is seen initially as a kind of, you know, keeper of the faith, then goes his own way, much to Freud's upset and so on. And I think that Roberto Asagioli is someone who most clearly thinks out what this idea of psychosynthesis is meant to be, and develops techniques which are very elaborated at a very early stage, some of which do, however, sound quite Jungian. So I mean, he writes in his book, Psychosynthesis, A Manual of Principles and Techniques, he talks about exercises and disidentification, techniques of visualization, techniques of auditory evocation, techniques of imaginative evocation and so on. And one wonders, of course, well, nobody knows at the time, but is this the kind of thing that Jung is doing in the Red Book? And Asagioli is advocating something pretty similar, but it doesn't involve painting and pictures and creating Red Books in the same kind of way. So I suppose, Jakob, one of the questions is, in psychoanalysis, are the differences as large as the people proposing them really believe they are? Or is there, in fact, much bigger overlap and a much greater sense in which, okay, there are different emphases and so on, but the goal is really very similar in each case. It's just the technicalities of how you get there. Because I certainly feel that misunderstandings that took place between Trieb and Jung, if Trieb had known that Jung was working on a Red Book, would Trieb have taken, would the relationship between them have fallen away in the same way that it actually did?
Okay, let's go back to that question soon. Where would you then place Roberto Asagioli in? Did he have a contact with Jung? I know he was at Birkholz Street. I know that Asagioli had contact with Freud. But do we know if he was also in contact with Troy?
I don't really know that he was in contact with. I think it's we've got these individual lines which are coming out of the early psychoanalytic community. Betilda seems to fall out of the picture very, very early. I haven't been able to find much more evidence of his activity. I think that Acciaiuoli badges this idea of psychosynthesis for himself very early on. And it's maybe one of the reasons that Jung decides to the label of analytical psychology is because psychosynthesis, this notion of psychosynthesis, is too easily associated with Acciaiuoli. I think that was one of the things to restate this point. Each thinker is trying to do is to profile their work and to, you know, communicate in a way which emphasizes what is distinctive about it, just in the same way that there's been very little discussion between, let's say, C.G. Jung and Rudolf Steiner. So, as far as I know, there's very little point of contact between Roberto Acciaiuoli and Jung.
Mm. And if we should focus in on Hans Trieb, most of the listeners might not even know his name, actually. Could you give a little bit of a background? Who is he? How does he get in contact with Jung?
Yeah. Of course, his name doesn't help, does it? Because if we translate Trieb into English, it's Mr. Miserable. and he's not at all a miserable figure. But in many ways, he's a kind of beacon of sanity in this whole enterprise of people being very competitive with their ideas and so on. So Trieb is born 26th of August, 1889, in a small town. He's the son of the local and the his mother, Emma. He's got four siblings. Very heavily involved at an early stage with the youth movement, Helvetia, and the Schweizer Wanderforum. And again, that's a kind of good example of the institutional culture which is going on behind so many intellectual enterprises of the time. One could also cite as a kind of analogous example the Jugendtag on the Hohe Meißner in 1913 in Germany, for which Ludwig Klages wrote his paper, Mensch und Erde, so humankind, human beings, and earth. Seminal paper for Klages' intellectual trajectory. Seminal paper, though often not referred to for the history of the Green Movement. And it's interesting, I think, just as a kind of bit of background to it, that although Klages wrote the paper, Mensch und Erde, he never actually went and delivered it in person. But it was included in the book of the meeting that took place for those who did. So Trieb is very much caught up in this sense of, you know, what is new, the Jugendbewegung, and often now sometimes looked at askance and seen as being intellectually dubious. But I think in the early stages of the Jugendbewegung is a search for something new in a sense of Aufbruch, a sense of things which are change in and im Wandel, in transition, I suppose, to use the title of Collected Works, Volume 10. And Trieb was part of that and was there, and I understand was very accomplished with his guitar playing skills as well. Then in 1909, he goes to the University of Geneva and undertakes a medical study. So he's got a similar kind of background to Jung in terms of coming from a small town, going and deciding that he can study at medicine. He undertakes a number of empirical scientific projects, which I've already mentioned. And therefore, it's at the Borg-Hotsley Clinic that the two of them meet. And I think, in fact, it's 1913 that Hans Trieb meets Jung. And they have, as far as one can tell, very positive relationship, very friendly, very warm relationship between them. That maybe casts light, perhaps, on the sense of disappointment of what happens. And when Jung sets up the Psychologische Club in 1916, then Trieb is going to be a member of that. In 1920, I think it is, he becomes the president of the Psychologische Club. So he's in there. He's part, you might say, of the inner circles in those early days of the development of analytical psychology. And then it seems it's in the 20s and around about 1922 that something goes wrong. And that's when there is a big break that takes place between Throop and Jung. Up until then, he's been more closely associated with the Psychological Orchestra of Throop. Jung also helps him set up his practice, helps him get lots of clients and so on. And then something goes wrong, and I don't think we're quite clear what it is, but it is tied up with the activities of the club, and should we say it's discursive culture of the time.
And is it correct that Hans Trieb was then introduced to Jung through Tonya Wolff, the sister of his wife?
No, that's a very good question. I don't know the Tonya Wolff connection there. That's interesting.
No, I think Susie Trieb, I think, was the sister of Tonya Wolff.
Right. Okay, right. So that might have helped cement the relationship as well. Certainly the contacts that they had together in the Burgholzlehr is
a strong part of the background. And when we say that they developed a relationship, I also read somewhere they went out sailing, they went on maybe bike tours together, they had this professional and but especially they had a private relationship, a friendship.
I think you're right to emphasize the fact that the relationship that was there was a very warm personal one as well as an intellectual one as well as a professional one. And of course it's so often the way, because I mean, you know, that's the story of Freud and Jung, isn't it? And bestest friends and all the communications they have together, very intensive exchange of correspondence, and then something happens and there is a falling apart and a falling away and the kind of bitterness which arises out of the sense of loss of a very close friendship. Now, I don't think the relationship between Troop and Jung is nothing, I think, can have the intensity of the Freud-Jung. That would be highly unusual. But they have very good professional relations, very, very good personal relations. And again, that's what I mean by this sense of a community, a cultural life. They spend time together. They undertake activities, going out on the lake together, and so on. And the story that's been told by Nadia Weber, who has been working to re-edit Troop's works, both his major work Heilung aus der Begegnung, so healing through encounter, and a very useful little collection of papers which came out just a few years ago called Welt und Selbst, so world and self. The story that Nadia Weber tells is that Jung used the Psychologische Club as a kind of laboratory for psychological group experiments. And the particular experiment, according to Weber, is that when the club met, or at least in some of their meetings, then the members of the club were meant to provoke each other, were meant to kind of have a jig at each other in order that repressed material would then come to the surface and become apparent. In other words, you would have, even though it's in a collective environment, you would have a sort of acting out of individuation and so on. And I'm very interested in this account because I've never heard anything like it said about the Psychologische Club. And I guess I can kind of see the thinking behind it and so on, that, you know, if you are going around provoking other people, then yeah, you will get a lot of unconscious material that will come to the surface. On the other hand, to someone who doesn't have an analytic training, it sounds like a recipe for disaster. If you have a group of people who are going to sit there and come out with negative remarks about each other, I don't see how that could possibly end in anything other than complete catastrophe.
Yeah, especially with a group of Jungians, I think that's very bad.
Well, you might say that.
But wasn't it also the case that they had the different visions around the Psychological Club, but Trieb had this idea of wanting to create a more, let's say, democratic place or a place where there's more meeting on eye level, while Jung was the founder, Jung was the big genius, and for Jung it was more an experimental place for his ideas to take root or be tested.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And again, I suppose that draws attention to the question of, you know, this is like a repeat of what happens in the psychoanalytic circles in Vienna. That, you know, they have the evening meetings and so on,
And Freud's view is, well, these events are to develop psychoanalysis and take psychoanalysis forward. And what happens actually is that the people there start to then go in their separate ways and the circle falls apart and all the attendant difficulties, including, I think, on Freud's part, then a sense of betrayal that, you know, this is, you know, you've all signed up to psychoanalysis and now you're breaking his fundamental tenets. That also, of course, was the accusation that he made of Jung as well, that in moving in particular away from the emphasis on the sexual nature of libido, that Freud that Jung is denying a chief tenet. Jung sees that as, well, Freud is turning this into a kind of church, into a kind of one-man show, into a kind of rigid dogma and so on, and I want to free myself from that. Then it's ironic that the similar kind of dynamic is said to have been playing itself out in the Psychologische Club, that Jung wants to then see it only as a vehicle for his ideas and not for anybody else's. And this time it's Trump, who falls into the role of being the person who's shifting it away from the emphasis on the father of ideas, if you like.
What catched me with Trump, and I think what comes most from the work in the practice room as a clinician, I found Trump's ideas resonating very much with me on a relational level. 60 years before anyone even mentioned terms like relational psychoanalysis or relational psychotherapy, he really emphasized the encounter between two people and the therapeutic effect of two people. Of course, we find that in Jung, of course, we find that in Freud in certain ways, but I'm thinking now when we speak about the different approach to the psychological club, his ideas is about him, and then with him, it seems like he comes more from a place of wanting to create less of hierarchy and more on meeting on sort of eye-to-eye level. But it just seems to me that there is something there where there is a contrast and where there might be a conflict, because as much as we can hear Jung speaking about that it's the relationship that heals, if one hears about Jung's work as an analyst, it often seems he's more there almost like a medicine man or is sharing his interpretation, while reading Hans Trieb, it feels more like a dialogue.
Yeah.
And I think we will also get to that when we continue and talk about Buber and how things develop between Martin Buber, which is another giant that we will make a link to. But I wanted to ask you first, because you said something interesting before, if I understood you right, if Trieb would have known about what Jung was working on in his Red Book, maybe things would have been different. Because in the background of this, I think they met 1913. In the background, we have Jung working on his own experiment.
Yes, just before I do that, I'll just to kind of wrap up that point about, you know, the purpose of the Psychologische Club and so on is, you know, I can sympathize with Freud and his view of the psychoanalytic circles in Vienna. You know, it wouldn't have come, that this culture, these circles wouldn't have come into being had it not been for Freud, or at least not in that form. And similarly, also, I can see that the function of the Psychologische Club is in some respects a strategic one, because it's meant to move things away from Vienna and to Zurich. And I think that very often when intellectual historians, you know, describe these shifts and moves, there's somehow a sense as if, you know, these great thinkers should be concerning themselves with such sort of grubby practical matters and so on. But I think you could look at it another way and say, you know, if you've got a big set of ideas and you want to get them out there and you want to have them propagated, you need to have an institution that's going to help you get it out there. It's a purely pragmatic thing in many ways. And I think that Jung was someone who was particularly shrewd at a very early stage in understanding that you had to get psychoanalysis to America. I remember when they set off on their journey, Freud is really very reluctant about the whole thing. He's fainting all the time and so on and so forth. Jung understands we've got to get psychoanalysis to contact with the wider world and America in particular. And of course, you know, Jung connects with the American university system, and he connects with Americans generally, and he offers seminars in English, the first seminars in Cornwall, then the seminars that he gives subsequently 1925, the Nietzsche seminars in 34 to 39. So he's very happy working in an English environment in a way that Freud never was. So I think this sense of having an institutional strategy doesn't have to be seen just as a sort of dark power game. Maybe there is a bit of dark power game in it, but equally there is a purely strategic consideration that needs to be thought of. And the reason why I make that point about Troop and the Red Book would it have been different if Jung had shared more widely what he was doing on his work in the Red Book? I wonder if, you know, because the Red Book is such a sign of vulnerability in many ways, that would have made people look at Jung in a different light, and it would have established a different kind of discursive environment for them to discuss differences, if indeed, you know, differences were of an intellectual of a principal kind, rather than differences of personality with them. And I think you're right, you've brought in this key notion for Troop, which is analogous to what one could find in Jung, but distinctively different in some ways, which is this idea of dialogue. A dialogue between two equal partners. And that seems to be fundamentally different from the way that Jung conceives of the cycle and encounter, which is in itself fundamentally different from the way that Freud sees it. So in the case of Freud, the psychoanalytic encounter, you have the psychoanalyst in the chair and the patient, client, whatever expression one's going to use, analysand on the couch, and without having visual contact. As I understand it, one of the innovations that Jung made was that you would have the analyst and the analysand would be facing each other, and it would be there, it would be more direct, you'd have visual contact there and so on. But Jung still seems to be operating with the idea that one finds in Freud of, you know, the Übertragung, the transference and the counter-transference. And Troop seems to take out that entire element of a fundamentally unconscious encounter, but which is what I see such a powerful idea with Jung, is that in the analytic session, the unconscious will react with that of the analyst. And this is, as it were, the motor that drives. You will know better than I will about this, Jacob, so you can correct me if I'm wrong on that. What it seems to me is particular about Troop, and what makes him interesting, is the idea that it is not simply a conscious encounter of two egos with unconscious reactions which are going on underneath the surface there, but rather that it is going to be an encounter of two selves. And that encounter is essentially going to be constructed in a way that he describes as dialogic. And then this fits into the broader question of how dialogism was seen in 20th century thought. And they are absolutely right. It's Martin Buber is the big figure.
Yeah, let's go to Buber. Do we know how they met and how it came to be that they started a dialogue, Buber and Troube?
I don't know what the personal connections were between Troube and Martin Buber, but it's in 1923, I think, that he first makes contact or intellectual contact with Buber when he reads Ich und Du. So I and thou, and du sounds, it's so much more natural in German than I and thou sounds so antiquated in English. I and you just sounds so banal. So again, it's one of these examples where something sounds very, very natural in German, hard to get that adequately and easily conveyed into. And well, of course, Buber in his own right, a huge intellectual figure, and you should definitely have a podcast on, get a proper Buber expert in and have a discussion about the role of Martin Buber more generally in relation to 20th century theology, because a key thinker there. And I think that's perhaps one of the sources of tension which later comes between Jung and Buber is to do with this fact of, you know, it's the two titans who are battling it out, but in the background is this fact that they had a common relationship to Hans Troop. So he's kind of caught in the middle, if you like,
between these two figures. And what Buber does in his works of 1922, Ich und Du, Zwiesprache, Dialogue, almost quoted that, 1932, the dialogical principle, das dialogische Prinzip of 1954, is to make this fundamental distinction between the I-it relation, essentially a way of relating as a subject to the world, which sees it purely as something which is an object, and the fundamentally different relation, which he calls that of the Ich-Du-Beziehung, the I-thou relation, which sees the world, sees other people in the world, not so much as objects, but as in themselves, individual, independent subjects, egos, eyes, whose subjectivity must be respected and recognized at all times, and essentially, and importantly so, must be recognized in order that an encounter, conversation, a dialogue can take place. And I think, I mean, it's such a simple distinction and yet such a powerful one, because, I mean, obviously one of the things that one thinks about is here we've got a critique of instrumental reason where we only see the world as something which is to be manipulated and exploited for our own purposes. I can hear echoes of Heidegger as well. The Seinsvergessenheit, that we don't recognize, as it were, the otherness of being, surely see it in terms of items which are vorhanden. So, again, we only have an instrumental relation to the world and forget something fundamental. Of course, Heidegger, another figure that Jung doesn't really have a lot of time for and so on. But that's the concept that Buber is introducing. And I think you can obviously see why this would have been so attractive to Hans Klug, because we've got the idea of fundamental recognition of the alterity of the other, but not just the otherness of the otherness of the other as a thou, as a subjectivity, and that has to be recognized in order for there to be, to use the phrase which you've alluded to, and a Begegnung of Augenhöhe, so a sense of an equal relation, an equal status of the partners in the conversation, in the dialogue, in the encounter that takes place. So it's a fundamental shift away from a model which involves either transference, in the case of Freud, counter-transference, or transference and counter-transference in the case of Jung, and something which places a priority not simply on the rationality of the encounter, but on something which is far more fundamental, a respect for the subjectivity of one's conversation partner. It's difficult to put into words, and actually, it isn't about words. It's about attitude. It's about how one conducts oneself and how one listens and responds to and respects what one's conversation partner is saying and doing. And of course, it has to be reciprocal. That's the whole point. And that's why when one tries to diagram these relations, there's a fundamental equality on both sides between the analyse and or the model that Klug will see it in Heilung aus der Begegnung. You know, that absolutely shows you the direction of travel that he's saying. There is something healing that can be brought out of an encounter, and what makes an encounter and not just an analytic hour session, is this idea of I and thou, the two thous who are going to be respecting each other.
Mm. And these ideas he then took and turned into practice. When he wrote a lot of case studies. He wrote a lot about the clinical work and how this would be practiced in the therapeutic encounter. I mean, his books are, correct me if I'm wrong, that they are mostly oriented to that type of therapeutic work, you would say, or more?
No. That's right. I mean, what we get in the essays that Trube writes and in Heilung aus der Begegnung is an insight into how these notions of psychosynthesis, how these notions of encounter, how these notions of psychospiritual healing are actually meant to work in the consulting room. And I think there is something refreshingly open, frank, about the way that Trube writes. It's a very simple style, but elegant, clear. There's sometimes a certain sort of rhetorical pathos, which sits somewhat uneasily for us today, but it's clear of those terrible linguistic contortions that, you know, you would find with Lacan or something like that. I mean, if you want a case of two extreme opposites in the therapeutic field, I think you'd cite Troup and Lacan as being the example of that. And what Troup is doing is playing his role in what one might describe as the relational turn in psychoanalysis, which emphasizes this question of, you know, the relation that's there, the dialogue that's there between the analyst and the analyst. And Troup describes it, in fact, as a dialogical anthropological model. And if you want to think about it in terms of the diagram, it has these wonderful, elegant little diagrams. You can think of the I'm going to use his vocabulary, the doctor on the one hand and the patient on the other. You have two egos which are there involved on both sides. You have on a subterranean, on an unconscious level, you have the shadow side that's there of each individual, both of the doctor and the patient. But central to both the doctor and the patient, central to both parties in this encounter, is then the self. And it's the relation between the selves which delivers the therapeutic effect. If we read Troup, that is what's going to bring about healing. Very strong words, Heilung there, obviously has a quasi-religious kind of sound to it as well. And I think it posits a view of the self as something which is achievable. And that's maybe another important distinction compared with Jung, where, you know, what would it mean to be the Selbst? What would it mean to constellate the Selbst? And as I read Jung, there's always a sense that the Selbst is a piece of work in progress that might never be achieved. That's not a reason for not striving to achieve it. It's really simply in the nature of the beast that it's always going to go on. And the Jungian self, it seems to me, remains a very powerful idea. It's a bit like Nietzsche's idea of the Übermensch, that it's very rare that you can actually point to somebody and say, okay, well, that's going to be the Übermensch. I mean, Nietzsche does, I know, in the case of Goethe. So Goethe has all the characteristics and is described as, you know, this is what an Übermensch would look like. But that's a pretty rare example. And I think Jung, he very shrewdly makes the point about Faust's redemption taking place not in this life, but in the afterlife, at least in some kind of mythical afterlife that's portrayed in the final concluding scene of Mounting Gorges at the end of Faust Part 2. And Jung makes the point in Psychology and Alchemy, he says there's something very suspect about this redemption because it's not achieved in the here and now. And of course, Jung's view of the position of the Selbst in the therapeutic process is that it is going to be in the here and now, that it's not just sort of wished away to some never and ever land. But that doesn't mean that it's going to be achieved. And just as there's no sense that Jung will say, well, I have achieved selfhood and so on. Nevertheless, you can point to, you know, examples and in memories, dreams, reflections, it seems to me that Jung tracks throughout his own life this gradual integrative approach that's taken place.
Yeah.
I mean, just to conclude that point, it's so significant, isn't it? Wouldn't you agree, Jakob, that the Red Book is never finished? It just breaks off.
Absolutely. But there is also something around what is it that heals, and there are different views about Jung's view versus Troup. If we follow Jung, we get different answers at different times in his life. But one of the answers that I think he would probably stand by at the end of his life is what heals is not this or that technique, but it's really the numinous. It's the experience of the numinous that is the healing aspect of a therapy, that you get to experience something that humbles you, what he would call the self. The experience of that can be deeply healing for an individual. While Troup would probably speak less about the numinous images and more about something that happens in that encounter, in that dialogue, in realizing the other person as a self or realizing oneself in relationship to the other person. For me, Troup has been like a balance point to Jung at times. in analysis, because it's like, oh, this is sort of grounded. And I think he also speaks about that, yes, he criticizes Jungian therapy to becoming too individualistic at times, or too much focused on the interior. And he says, like, healing has to do with, yes, that meeting between two, but also to go out into the world and adapt actually to society. And I feel like the whole different parts of the thread that in my own encounters has been really helpful. There's some humility or some sort of groundedness in Trub that the counterbalances at times Jung's more bombastic or explosive idea around healing and also maybe expectations on healing. There's a lot of focus on this archetypal experience, while, at least from what I've read, you get very little of that in Trub.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right, and the whole question of numinosity, the sacred, the archaic, all of these kind of wonderful conceptual and experiential areas that are so important for Jung, you really don't find out that in Trub at all. It's much more sober. It's much more a clear cut. You don't have all, you know. You can't imagine Trub going on about, you know, the forces of Votan marching around and then some. So it is a psychoanalysis, I wouldn't say without the sacred, but a psychoanalysis without the numinous and without the archaic and the primordial and, you know, all of that kind of area which Jung delves into, and which is over very, very important for him. That there is a kind of clarity, a sort of Apollonian rather than Dionysian kind of aspect to Trub. And I think you're right, that there is a kind of balance there. I guess I would say that both of them see the purpose of therapy not simply as to patch up the individual, but to construct or allow to constellate itself a more natural, a more integrative kind of self. It's just that the ways that they're going to be used are going to be very different. Another example, I can't imagine Trub getting interested in synchronicity. I can't see Trub getting involved with Wolfgang Pauli. You know, quantum Jung, that makes sense. Quantum Trub, I find it harder to imagine. Or indeed that all of the interlocutors that Jung has in other areas, there is a kind of a focus in Trub, almost a kind of modesty, but a sense of, well, I suppose it stems from this dialogic idea that it's as you've suggested with Jung, it's less about, you know, the great theorist, the shaman, the charismatic individual. That's not what Trub's about. Maybe that makes Trub a better psychoanalyst. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe for some. But his work was really to try to build some bridge or connection between Buber and Jung through his work, trying to synthesize these two ideas into something new, or like to bring them together.
That's right. I think that he understands the significance of what Buber is elaborating and its analytic, its therapeutic applicability. Problem with this is, in trying to bring about a rapprochement, is the falling out that takes place between Jung and Buber quite a few years on now. I think we're talking about 1952 in the big debate that takes place in Merkur. It is in 1952 that Buber publishes in the German intellectual periodical Merkur, very influential journal, a real kind of intellectual powerhouse, publishes an article on religion and modern thought. And in some ways, it seems to me that this is a counterpart to picking up on what Jung wrote in 1928 in his article, Das Seelenproblem des modernen Menschen, so the soul problem of modern man. To give it its English title, lacking in inclusivity, but that's how it's translated in volume 10 of the collected works, and it's a very strange essay that Jung writes. It's published in the Europäische Revue, which is a kind of conservative-leaning, cultural conservative-leaning journal. Subsequently is republished in a collection of Jung's own papers in the 1930s. And in that, in Das Innere Problem des Modernen Menschen, Jung discusses, you know, the religious problem, the decline of religion, the pseudo religions that are on the move, and he's, I suppose, eyeing up the competition in some way. So he's looking at theosophy. He's got no time for theosophy, no time for Madame Blavatsky, no time for Rudolf Steiner, no time for anthroposophy. He makes very dismissive remarks about people who go and build temples in Dornach and so on. So he's obviously got the Goetheanum in sights and so on. And is a kind of reappraisal of the spiritual question, the religious question, after the Great War. Really interesting and insightful paper, and it's got a tone which is I think not typical to the way that we find Jung writing about things. And religion and modern thought is Buber's kind of equivalent, only written in the progressive, or rather more progressive journal, Merkur. And one of the things that he does when he's reviewing the question of religion and modern thought is to discuss Jung, and critically to describe Jung's view of religion as being Gnosticism. And this is the accusation that Buber makes, that Jung is a Gnostic, that Jung really doesn't like at all. Now Buber knows whereof he's speaking. He'd moved in analytical psychological circles. We've talked about the friendship that he has with, in 1923, Buber delivered a lecture, The Psychologizing of the World, at the so-called Orgschulgruppe in Zurich. In 1934, he attended and lectured at the Eranos conferences, of course, with which Jung was very, very closely associated. So whatever one makes of Buber's assessment, it's based on knowledge of the subject area. And Jung is very, very negative in his response. He writes a rejoinder titled Religion and Psychology, which appears in May issue. Buber writes in February, Jung hits back in May. And in the same issue, Buber replies, and the contributions to this debate that are taking place in Merkur are written in his own work. Is then, Buber takes his own work and puts it into his book, the very famous Eclipse of God, Gottes Finsternis of 1952. And of course, one of the questions is, but why does Jung object so much to being described as a Gnostic? The obvious point of reference is Seven Sermons to the Dead, where Jung apparently writes in the position of Basilides and so on. There's the whole interest in Gnosticism that we find it's obvious. And yet, Jung reacts very badly to being described as such. And in many ways, it's been a bit of a puzzle. I think two things that can help explain that puzzle would be the fact that in his 1928 paper, Jung accuses precisely anthroposophy and theosophy and other similar movements of being Gnostic. And he says, it's quite polemical, his tone. He says, he talks about the widespread interest in all sorts of psychic phenomena, including spiritualism, astrology, theosophy, parapsychology, and so forth. The world, he says, has seen nothing like it since the end of the 17th century. We can compare it only to the flowering of Gnostic thought in the first and second centuries after Christ. The spiritual currents of our time have, in fact, a deep affinity with Gnosticism. There's even an Église Gnostique de la France, and I know of two schools in Germany which openly declare themselves Gnostic. And I think, you see, you'll find that, you know, Jung is taking a very negative view there of Gnosticism. And I think what he objects, it's in this sense that he objects to Buber describing him, Jung, as Gnostic. And he says, no, I'm nothing to do with these other movements. That's why you have misunderstood me. The other element, of course, is this friendship with Tuo in the background. You know, the issues that are still there in the falling apart of the friendship, this can't help make Jung more sympathetic or more inclined to different kind of response to what Buber writes about in Being Gnostic. And I suppose there's maybe a third reason as well, which is that anybody who is a Gnostic will precisely say they're not one. I mean, that's kind of part of the Gnostic deal in a way. But I wonder if that is, if we read Buber's 1952 essay, which then goes into Eclipse of God, in the light of what Jung writes in 1928 and his critique of what he sees as Gnosticism then, that helps explain why he doesn't want to be badged as Gnostic by Buber of all people, who is this friend of his own former friend, Hans Jung.
I think those all three reasons could be parts of it, but isn't it also true that Jung always, when attacked publicly, wants to defend his persona as a scientist of the time or as a psychologist or psychiatrist, that he needs to sort of stay away from labels like that? Isn't it also him is protecting himself, his professional? Isn't that one level to this that he publicly almost had to, or still struggles to the end of his life with this, wanting to be taken serious and be viewed as some sort of science, or being upset at the end of his life where people are more interested in Freudian ideas? It seems like he was still fighting also for his theoretical system being accepted.
That's an interesting question, Jakob. And it reminds me of the argument that Peter Kingsley has made in Catafalque about this whole question of how do we take, I mean, Kingsley's argument in a nutshell is that Jung is a prophet. And yet part of the prophecy is in a way to be careful and with how one announces it. And I think Kingsley teases out quite well the complexity of this relationship between the prophetic, or however one initiatory, however one wants to describe it, aspect of Jung, the part that we were talking about earlier, the numinous, the archaic, the primordial, and so on, and then the fact that, as you say, has also a doctor, an identity as a doctor or as a psychologist, as a clinician, shall we say. And you know, there's a workaday world to it, which is proposing something that will offer healing, redemption, maybe even to those who seek analysis with him. And so there certainly is a tension that's there. Of course, one of the things that I'm thinking one would say about Jung, if he doesn't want to be seen as a Gnostic, is why he keeps on referring to Gnosticism. I mean, Aeon being a very good case in point. Or again, if you want to be seen purely as a doctor or a clinician, why is he writing books about alchemy all the time? So, or flying saucers. I mean, that wonderful letter that he writes on flying saucers.
He's writing all these books, but he's also trying to build them into a system of psychology that he's trying to get accepted. I mean, even Aeon, he's all the time linking back to his theory of the psyche, which is this universal theory that can be adapted on anyone, anywhere.
I think that's a very fair point. I suppose it then comes down to this question of the various ways that one has of seeing Jung. And some people are going to come down and say, well, actually, at the end of the day, he is an analyst, a medical doctor. Peter King is going to come and say, well, at the end of the day, he's a prophet. I suppose at the end of the day, I think of him as a Kulturkritiker, a bubble, as someone who is receiving and working within the tradition of German thought, German Catholicism, and German Romanticism. But that isn't to deny that there is clearly a clinical aspect, or even if one follows Kingsley, a prophetic aspect, or equally with Buber, a Gnostic aspect, is the question of, you know, where does the emphasis lie at the end?
Last minute, coming back to Tru, because it's easy to forget him when as soon as one speaks about Jung again or Buber again, Tru is this. Where is he now? In the background somewhere. He's not a giant. He's not a charismatic figure. I only seen one picture of him. So he died 1949 in a heart attack. Since then, is there a legacy of Tru? Is there a future for Tru? What happened sense, because again, he's one of those unsung heroes. Now we're giving him some voice, we're giving him some space, and you're also sharing with me there are people working on publishing more of his work.
I think there is something of a troupe, the Renaissance underway. It's not very grand, isn't it? It's not very grandiose, but it is steady. The publication, republication of Heilung in the Begegnung and the essays and Schelfel World, very, 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 very important. I think it forms part and parcel of a larger piece of work that needs to be done, which is to introduce the extraordinarily productive work of German-speaking Jungian analysts to an Anglo-American audience. I mean, whenever I go to a Jungian conference in Germany, I look at the books, the conference bookstalls. I'm just amazed at how much work is there, and which, because it's translated, doesn't make itself into the Anglo-American reception, whereas the other way around tends to be the case, that a lot of Anglo-American authors then get translated into German. Or actually the fact that German Jungians have got enough English, they can go and read them in English, and that doesn't apply the other way around, and so on, with notable exceptions to be sure. So I think the fact that that Troop's works are becoming available again is tremendously helpful. I would like to see also translations of the work. And he's not as difficult to translate as Jung is. But I think it's to capture the tone is sometimes hard in English. I'll just sort of read a little extract here of something which perhaps answers this question of why should we be interested in Troop. A little passage written by Troop, which I've translated, which goes like this. He says, "Psyche and world, or more precisely, being in hock to the self and being caught up in the world, are the two extremes of securing one's existence between that which an immature individual is tossed to and fro like a ball. Losing oneself, one is enthralled to the world, and asserting oneself, one loses the world. And correspondingly, loss of self and loss of world are the two associated dangers to which we are exposed as we try to escape this worrying contradiction and to find safety in the one or the other. From the worries and woes of this tension between the opposites, compromise offers no escape. The only thing that can offer rescue is a recognition, one through suffering, of this tension as an unavoidable fact of human existence in the world and of standing firm in it with an awareness of one's responsibilities. This is not something we voluntarily take on ourselves. Only accept to embark on this adventure when necessity compels us to do so. And this necessary compulsion teaches us in one way or another at a particular moment, or in other words, when there is a neurosis. This is the incurable sickness that brings healing, which draws the lost individual into the central point of one's self-discovery. It does not let us go until we have successfully emerged from this middle point into a new relation to the world."